Holidays bring feasting, fluffy dinner rolls, tasty stuffing, and your family's French toast bakes. With Hero Bread, indulge in your holiday favorites. Made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, bagels, croissants, buttermilk biscuits, and more. And don't forget their Hero Hawaiian rolls. With 4 grams of protein and 0 grams net carbs. Hero Bread has you covered with 0 to 5 grams net carb and higher fiber options. So your holidays stay delicious and balanced. Like their 3 grams net carb pan of chocolate. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at HERO.CO. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains up to 17 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.
Indulge in all your holiday faves this season, knowing you're getting the good stuff your body craves with Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake. It's your post-holiday recovery kit with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. And it actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you can even savor the season with their limited edition chocolate mint. There are endless ways to personalize your Ka'Chava, whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee. With every 2 scoops of Ka'Chava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's Ka'Chava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, and use code NEWS.
Welcome to the deep dive. So this is where we take a heavy stack of source material. We're talking legal briefs, political claims, financial histories, and just, you know, cut through all the noise.
We really want to give you the essential insights, the context you need to actually understand what's going on.
And our sources this week, they touch on these surprisingly connected themes.
They really do. It's all about accountability, influence, and how cold, hard financial realities can just change history. The goal is to make those connections really clear for you.
Okay, so we are tackling 3 major areas today, plus a really fascinating little historical footnote at the end.
Yeah.
We're going to start with a massive legal win in the Nevada fake elector case. Then we have a multi-part hypocrisy report,
which covers some pretty high-ranking political figures.
Then you're going to get into some previously unexamined details from the Jeffrey Epstein email releases. These focus less on the headlines and more on his enduring global influence.
And we wrap it all up with a quiet, official end of a 233-year-old piece of American history.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
So we begin with legal accountability, a really significant moment in the Nevada fake elector battle. Now, for those of you following the news, you know that after the 2020 election, Trump-affiliated individuals tried to cast fraudulent electoral votes in a few swing states.
Right. And in a lot of those states, the cases have just stalled out.
Totally. I mean, you've got procedural arguments in Georgia, a really slow-moving process in Arizona.
And the judge's ruling in Michigan, which was interesting.
It was. But Nevada was different. The primary fight there wasn't really about the crime itself, but about jurisdiction.
Where the trial should actually happen.
Exactly. The state attorney general, Aaron Ford, he brought the case in Las Vegas.
Which makes sense. That's where a lot of the plotting happened. And you're likely to get a more, let's say, neutral jury pool.
But the defense, they fought back hard on this. They argued the whole case belonged 400 miles north in Carson City, the state capital.
Because that's where the signing happened.
Precisely. They claimed the core crime was forgery and that it was committed right there in Carson City when they signed the fake electoral certificates. A lower court even sided with them at first.
Yeah, that was a huge blow to the prosecution. But they appealed to the Nevada Supreme Court, which came back with a unanimous 6-0 ruling in Ford's favor.
Unanimous.
And the court's decision, according to the sources, was just brilliantly simple. It rested on a point of law that defines when a crime is actually, you know, complete.
Okay, so walk us through that logic. If the defense is saying the crime was finished the second the pen left the paper in Carson City, what was their fatal flaw?
Well, the fatal flaw was their whole definition of forgery.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court basically said, look, you can forge documents all day long in your basement.
And it's not illegal.
Not yet. Forgery only becomes a crime, legally speaking, the moment you attempt to pass those forged documents off as real to someone else.
Oh, I see. So the signing in Carson City was just the prep work.
Exactly. The crime itself didn't actually happen until the documents were delivered and received. The goal was to defraud the courts and the judges.
Who were in Las Vegas.
Precisely. So the injury, the actual attempt to pass off the forgery, that didn't occur until the documents were received in Las Vegas. The court just affirmed that Nevada law lets you bring charges in any location where a crime unfolds across multiple jurisdictions.
So that technical argument from the defense just got completely neutralized.
Crashed and burned.
So what does this win really mean for you, the listener? It means the prosecution is back on track in Las Vegas, and the sources are noting that the defendants, who created a, quote, paper trail a mile wide, are getting pretty nervous.
Well, especially since some were apparently hoping for a presidential pardon if Trump were to be reelected.
And that right there is the key takeaway.
It's the absolute key. If you're charged with a state crime, a U.S. president cannot pardon you. It's just not in their power.
Nevada's justice system is totally independent of federal pardons.
So this breakthrough pretty much ensures that the Nevada case, unlike a lot of the others, has a very high probability of being the first and maybe the only fake elector case that actually gets before a jury.
Okay, moving on. Let's shift gears to our hypocrisy report. This is where we highlight those profound contradictions where powerful figures seem to have one set of rules for themselves.
And a totally different set for everybody else.
Yeah.
So we can start with immigration. Specifically, the rhetoric versus the actual labor practices.
Okay.
Donald Trump, as we know, built his political brand on some very strong anti-immigrant and xenophobic rhetoric.
Right.
Yeah. And yet, the sources confirm that last year the Trump Organization received 184 H-2A and H-2B temporary worker visas. That's the highest number they have ever received.
And just to clarify for you, H-2A is for temporary agricultural work, and H-2B is for seasonal non-ag work.
The very kind of jobs that his rhetoric often portrays as being stolen by immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And that number, the 184, that's on top of the nearly 400 workers they have with permanent resident visas.
So the total figures are up something like 40% since 2017.
The irony is, well, it's unavoidable.
Okay, so from immigration to the justice system.
Yeah, let's pivot that contradiction into pardons and political attacks.
Oh.
The sources point out that Republicans often use these tragic, violent crimes committed by people released under Democratic policies.
We all remember cases like Willie Horton or, more recently, the murder of Laken Riley.
Exactly. Those become central points in political campaigns. So the source material offers a counterpoint. A man named Jonathan Braun.
Okay, who's Jonathan Braun?
Braun was convicted of some very serious crimes, money laundering, drug trafficking back in 2019. He was then pardoned by Donald Trump.
And the reason for the pardon?
According to the source, it wasn't for compassionate reasons or new evidence. It was because Braun's family are personal friends with Jared Kushner's family.
A political connection.
And the results of that pardon have been, frankly, devastating. Since his release, Braun has allegedly assaulted his wife, his 75-year-old father-in-law, a 3-year-old boy. He also attacked his nurse with an IV pole, allegedly molested his kid's nanny, and ran a predatory loan sharking scheme. He's now headed back to prison for years.
So the contrast is just incredibly stark.
It is. Between how a case like this, based on connections, is handled versus those used for political attacks.
Okay, next up is political data and claims of fraud.
Right. So in Tennessee, the Secretary of State, Tree Hargett, referred 42 non-citizens to the FBI for allegedly illegally voting. The intention was to show that systemic fraud was a real problem.
But the number itself tells a different story.
It really does. Because that number 42 people represents 0.00001% of the total voting population in Tennessee.
So if the goal is to prove widespread systemic fraud,
this number actually documents how infinitesimally small the possible problem is. The data becomes its own contradiction.
And the sources suggest that was maybe the point. The goal was never to prove systemic fraud, but just to get the number of alleged instances out there, no matter how small. It's the implication that matters.
Precisely. And the final piece here, it involves a shocking reversal on special prosecutors.
Right. So the context for you is that the Trump defense team is arguing in court that Jack Smith's appointment to the classified documents case was illegal because he wasn't properly confirmed by the Senate.
But the sources reveal that the very same administration, when they were trying to prosecute people they saw as political enemies, like James Comey or Letitia James, they used an unconfirmed appointee.
Her name was Lindsay Halligan. Her background was mostly in insurance law.
And when her legitimacy was challenged, the government quickly used a backup step, appointing her as a special prosecutor.
So the contradiction is?
Blatant. Smith's appointment is illegal. But Halligan's was not only legal, but necessary.
So what happened in the courtroom?
It got pretty dramatic. The sources detail this exchange where the judge asked the DOJ attorney to explain the difference between Smith who has decades of high-level experience, and Halligan.
And what did he say?
He claimed that Smith did not meet the qualifications to be appointed, but that Halligan did.
The career prosecutor is unqualified, but the insurance lawyer is.
You can imagine the reaction. The sources say there were audible gasps in the courtroom. It just shows that in this particular arena, the legal argument often seems to come second to the political goal.
Okay, let's shift now. Let's explore the details coming out of the Jeffrey Epstein email releases. The headlines always grab onto the celebrity stuff, but the real insights are about his continued influence after his conviction.
Yeah, he remained incredibly connected. Post-conviction, the sources show he was meeting or emailing with just a stunning list of global power players. We're talking Peter Thiel, former UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown.
Scholar Noam Chomsky, then former Israeli PM Ehud Barak.
And even the then current president of Mongolia, he was not hiding out.
No, not at all. He was still operating as this power broker, this intellectual advisor, giving financial counsel to people like Larry Summers, members of the Rothschild family, unnamed Middle Eastern sheiks.
And an unnamed country leader.
There's also this personality detail that comes through in the emails.
That he was a highly self-regarding, almost pompous ass.
Yes, constantly sending articles on science and psychology, writing these long essays on his own theories to friends like Chomsky. He clearly thought he was the smartest person in any room.
And the emails also get into the volatile dynamics around Bill Clinton.
Right. Both Clinton and the Gores were adamant they had never been to the island. And at some point before 2016, the relationship between Epstein and Clinton clearly soured.
Massively. Epstein started calling Clinton a friend killer.
And one of Epstein's email confidants went even further, calling Clinton very close to being a psychopath with no conscience and scary because of his ability to lie.
Which is a pretty heavy charge.
It is. But then there's this one moment of what seems like humility from Epstein. In an exchange, he admits he was humbled and that his friend was right about something related to Clinton.
As if even he had been surprised by something the former president did.
Now, we do have to address this very niche and difficult political reference that came up in the emails.
We do. In an exchange with the journalist Michael Wolff, Wolff asks about a reference to Nussbaum Foster, which relates to some, you know, old dark fringe conspiracy theories from the 90s.
And Epstein replies at the line, Hillary Clinton doing naughties with Vince Foster.
And it is so important to emphasize here, just as the source material does, that this is purely a claim made in a private email.
Right. And the nature of the naughties, whether it's a video, a picture, a drawing, it's not specified or verified at all by the source. It just documents the kind of speculative material being shared between them.
It does. And on the Republican side, the connections were there too. He spent time in Palm Beach with all the Trump boys in December of 2016.
And his correspondence with Steve Bannon started in 2017, and they became, quote, close friends by March 2018. The influence really did span the entire political spectrum.
It did. And then there's this final, truly bizarre alleged claim from the emails.
About pictures of Trump blowing Bill Clinton.
Which Putin may possess. Mm-mm. And the commentary from the source on this is actually pretty insightful.
I thought so too.
It argues that even if the act were consensual, it only becomes politically compromising because of the embarrassment, which is compounded by Trump's choice to align himself with political homophobes.
So the compromise is basically self-inflicted.
Exactly. It's about using shame as a political weapon, even in the most outlandish of scenarios.
Okay, let's transition now to a final and pretty surprising fact. Today, in numismatics, after 233 years, an era has ended.
It has. The U.S. Mint produced its very last penny in Philadelphia this week.
And this was really just an exercise in financial common sense.
Or a lack thereof, until now. For years, the cost of making a single penny had risen to about 4 cents per coin.
4 cents to make 1 cent.
Yeah. Keeping the penny in circulation was costing the U.S. government over $50 million a year. Mm. Its financial relevance in an age of electronic commerce has just plummeted.
The sources note the last time the U.S. actually retired a coin was the half cent, all the way back in 1857.
Which brings up a really interesting linguistic question, right? About language versus currency. Will phrases like, a penny saved is a penny earned, or a penny for your thoughts survive?
Or do they have to evolve now? A nickel for your thoughts. It doesn't have the same ring.
It doesn't. But language is incredibly resistant to change. I mean, think about Pennywise, pound foolish. That phrase has survived for centuries, even though the U.S. hasn't used pound sterling in, well, forever.
The symbolism outlives the currency.
It often does. And on a historical note, Lincoln was put on the penny back in 1909 specifically to emphasize his role as the president of the common man.
And now he's just on the $5 bill. George Washington is the only president left who appears on commonly circulating paper money and coins.
The sources did mention some interesting conceptual discussions around coinage, like if Washington were ever removed from the quarter.
Who would replace him?
One suggestion was Theodore Roosevelt, the argument being he's arguably the best president who doesn't have his own coin.
That's a good point. And another really thoughtful suggestion was Rosa Parks.
Which creates this powerful historical parallelism. She paid a 15-cent bus fare in 1955.
Which she likely would have paid with a quarter and gotten a dime back.
Exactly. And that connects so nicely to the Roosevelt dime, which was created because of his support for the March of Dimes charity.
Okay, so let's synthesize everything we've covered.
Right. So we saw a law defining accountability in Nevada, ensuring justice finds its intended venue. We saw how self-interest exposed these massive contradictions in political power through the hypocrisy of visas, pardons, and selective legal arguments.
And we looked at how global influence and information brokering continued for Jeffrey Epstein, way outside the spotlight.
And finally, we saw how the simple economics of commerce dictates change with the end of the penny.
The key takeaways for you are pretty numerous. There's that specific legal definition that the crime in the Nevada forgery case was completed upon receipt, not signing.
The massive increase in foreign workers at the Trump Organization, which contrasts so sharply with the political rhetoric.
The shocking fact that a dangerous criminal received a pardon based purely on his family's connection to the Kushners.
And of course, the official start of a new era of American currency without the cent.
So here is a final provocative thought for you to consider.
We learned that the cost of keeping the physical penny in circulation was over $50 million a year. So now that the physical penny's gone, will the historical and symbolic value of that phrase, a penny saved is a penny earned, finally be upgraded by a culture that increasingly values dollars and cents over history and symbolism?
Will the language of our personal finances evolve now that the smallest denomination of our physical wealth is just gone?
Something to think about.
Food for thought, indeed. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.